From the University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio, this is In Black America.
There was a young man organizing the march named Bayard Rustin. Mm-hmm. And when Bayard called people, no, you did. There was no, you couldn't say no. Bayard was, first he was Dr. King's lieutenant, but he had the capacity to organize hundreds of thousands of people. And he, when he has a plan and a program, you know, he calls you and he tells you how the whole thing depends on you. If you don't show up, you don't do what you're supposed to, the whole thing is going to collapse and it's going to be blamed on you. Bayard reached out to me and to Ruby and just said, we need somebody to MC the first part of the program in the March on Washington while the people are assembling. There needs to be entertainment and we need somebody to sort of keep it going. So Ruby, you and Ossie, you are selected.
The late Ossie Davis. For 7 decades, Davis led a distinguished career as an actor, writer, director, and producer. Along with his beloved wife, Ruby Dee, he was a renowned civil rights activist and an unforgettable figure in the African-American struggle for equality. In 1946, he began his acting career in Harlem. He made his film debut in 1950 in the Sidney Poitier film, No Way Out. Davis experienced many of the same struggles that most African-American actors of his generation underwent. He wanted to act but did not want to play stereotypical subservient roles such as butler that were the standard for African-American actors of his generation. Instead, he tried to follow the example of Poitier and played more distinguished characters. When he found it necessary to play a Pullman porter or a butler, he tried to inject the role with a certain degree of dignity. In 1998, Davis and Ruby Dee published their dual autobiography, In This Life Together, in celebration of their 50th wedding anniversary. On February 4th, 2005, Davis was found dead in Miami, where he was making a movie. I'm John L. Hanson, Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America. On this week's program, Ossie and Ruby, In This Life Together, In Black America.
In the Hollywood entertainment industry syndrome, professional or an actor is looked on as a celebrity, as a commodity, and is taught to teach the public to worship himself or herself as an object of divine whatever. Mm-hmm. And if you begin to consider only yourself, if yourself is your only object, then all other things will begin to fall away from you. You have to learn in this business that yourself cannot be your only object. You have to say, myself and my wife and my children, those are the things that mean the most to me, and I don't care what fame does or celebrity does, that's where I will be going, and that's where I stake my claim. You have to be tough and say, I'm gonna make this marriage work, because if I lose this one, the only thing I can do is get another, which will be just like it, so I might as well make this one work.
Ossie Davis and Ruby Dee were one of the most revered couples of the American stage, two of the most prolific and fearless artists in American culture. As individual and as a team, they created profound and lasting work that has touched all of us. With courage and tenacity, they often broke new ground for African Americans and opened many a door previously shut tight to African American artists. This generation may recognize Davis and Dee for their appearances in several Spike Lee movies, including Malcolm X, in which Davis played himself, having delivered the eulogy for the slain civil rights leader. Born on December 18, 1917, in Cogsdale, Georgia, the oldest of 5 children, Davis grew up in Waycross, Georgia. On December 9, 1948, Davis and Ruby Dee were married. In 1950, they made their film debut in No Way Out with Sidney Poitier and then starred together on Broadway in A Raisin in the Sun. In honoring this legendary couple and celebrating the birthday of Davis, In Black America presents this rebroadcast of a 1998 interview regarding the publication of their dual autobiography.
I finally persuaded Ozzy to write this book. And after 50 years later, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so we finished that. William Morris is publishing it. It chronicles our lives from before we... I mean, it's about our lives from before we met each other to when we met, and all through our time up until now.
One seems to forget that all of us are human beings under our stardom or whatever our vocation. Was it difficult in going back and reliving those early years?
Not difficult in an emotional sense.
Although sometimes it was that too.
It was that. But what was difficult was that we found that we had different memories often of the same thing.
Okay.
And sometimes we couldn't reconcile our differences. So I wrote my version. Ruby wrote her version. May the best contestant emerge triumphant.
And then sometimes it's conversation. Sometimes it's, dialogue. Mm-hmm. And then we take chapters. The format kind of varies, you know, like that.
Like life does.
Mm-hmm.
How long did it take you all to put this work together?
Two solid years.
But Ozzy wasn't solid because in between that we were working. One of us would be away, and thank God Ozzy's the writer in the family, so he kind of kept us on track. And we were working with a wonderful woman, you know, Sydney Mahone, whom I know as a dramaturge, and others were helping us with research. So that was and our children sometimes, especially my daughter Nora, helping us with the memories when they were small, and so. It was so that helped a great deal, but I just had to quarrel a little bit with that word solid, and also those times when we had some disagreements too about this and that.
But we never came to blows.
No, we never came to blows. Mm-hmm.
Mr. Davis, are you still your own editor and censor?
I am still my own editor and censor, but I found out that a lot of people have gotten into the act, so It's me and a whole board of directors telling me what to do.
Tell our audience how you all met in 1948.
Well, now, let's talk
your
about
version.
That a minute here.
Your Ruby. Version.
We were both involved in a play called Jib.
Mm-hmm.
And we met at the New Amsterdam Theater on 42nd Street in New York.
Yes. Is that where the Lion King is now?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That first day at rehearsal. And it didn't seem extraordinary to me at all. And
I came on board as an understudy, see?
Yeah.
And I had seen his picture in the paper, but I hadn't met him. But I didn't even like his picture because I had wondered some other people I knew from the American Negro Theater, that's the community theater where I got into the business. I wanted one of those guys to get the lead. So I was really very disappointed. And then when I saw him, it was even worse because I thought he looked so peculiar. I was just, and his understudy and I used to sit in the auditorium and kind of talk about him, you know,
mm-hmm.
because he was this tall, skinny guy that looked like with this big Adam's apple that went up and down when he talked, and he kind of like spilled along out of his, and hung out of his clothes. The clothes were too, you know, it's like this tall, skinny guy wearing the clothes of this short, fat man. he just looked strictly from poverty, but he didn't seem to be self-conscious about it or anything.
I had my mojo going.
But we agreed that he was a good actor, you know.
And that's how it all got started.
You all have been very involved with the activism of this country. How has that paralleled you all's acting careers?
Well, first let me say that we have been involved in activism in our country, but remember, activism has been involved with us.
I understand.
We were born black, and when we married in 1948, being black was not a happy state of affairs in this country. There were many places where people couldn't vote. People were still getting lynched. Soldiers returning from the war were being killed if they lined up to vote. So when we came into the theater, we were already in the midst of the struggle of our people for dignity and work and freedom. We had no option. There was no way of get out of being black, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So you had to get b- buckle down and struggle.
And also our parents. I think about my mother walking picket lines on 125th Street. We went with her, picketing for jobs in the stores where we couldn't work, but we could only go there and buy. We couldn't own stores on 125th Street. You know, I remember that kind of activity and, since I remember, and the poverty and the people being put out in the street. So we were kind of born, both of us, from different parts of the country.
Mm-hmm. And I remember on two occasions when my father's life was threatened by the Ku Klux Klan. And on one occasion, we stayed up all night waiting for the Klan to come. They didn't come, but we got the message, you know. So struggle was always a part of who I was and a part of who Ruby was.
And also it was part of the marriage, too, because the times that we live in affect you in personal ways, too. I preceded Women's Lib, and as I look back, that affected me a lot because I had no ways of thinking about what I felt was ailing me, what I felt was wrong with my being married and all that thing. You know, after once I got used to it, and I said, oh, this thing is unfair. This is it's lopsided, you know, when it comes to the involvement of women and men. And so the whole thing struck me after we got married. So as I began this quest, this scratching, this search, and honestly, being a sensitive person, thank God, we managed to scratch our way and move our way into another level of understanding as human beings. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. But part of it, I think, Ruby, was because we knew how to struggle even with each other. We knew how to fight with each other.
Yeah.
We knew how to try and arrive at some common truth that would embrace us both. And we had some marvelous examples when we came into the business. Paul Ropes and Canada Lee. Beautiful young lady named Lena Horne out in Hollywood fighting, you know. So there were examples all along the way that led us into the struggle. And we found that the struggle was our mother, and it kept us so busy that we never had time to stop and ask ourselves if we were happy.
Yeah.
You know, we didn't have time for that. There were too many.
The involvements were more important than any kind of like disagreements. That's how it seemed to work out. We had so much to do where there was some common thing happening.
Yeah.
We didn't have too long to spend on our personal things. Although we did, we managed to have a few long pouts, you know, going.
Oh, yeah. We had a full personal life. But, you know, if you sit in front of the television in 1963 and you look at what's happening in Birmingham and the dogs snapping at children, the water hose knocking people off their feet, you don't look at your wife and say, I wonder if I'm happy. You get mad as hell. You want to do something about it. You know, so the struggle catches you up in it. It's a part of who you are, and it certainly helped to keep us together and define who we were and what we had to do in this life. Struggle is the center of existence as far as we're concerned, and we intend to keep struggling until we die.
How did you all happen to become the MC of the March on Washington in August 63?
There was a young man organizing the march named Bayard Rustin.
Mm-hmm.
And when Bayard called people, you couldn't say no. Bayard was, first he was Dr. King's lieutenant, but he had the capacity to organize hundreds of thousands of people. And when he has a plan and a program, you know, he calls you and he tells you how the whole thing depends on you. If you don't show up, if you don't do what you're supposed to do, the whole thing is going to collapse and it's going to be blamed on you. Bayard reached out to me and to Ruby and just said, we need somebody to MC the first part of the program in the March on Washington while the people are assembling.
Mm-hmm.
There needs to be entertainment, and we need somebody to sort of keep it going. So, Ruby, you and Ossie, you are selected.
What was the feeling once you heard the I Have a Dream speech at the march?
Well, it was, remember, it was a 250,000 people there, and it had been a most exciting day. And believe it or not, there had been some other very exciting speeches, but that certainly was the one that topped them all. And we found ourselves, after the speech, just sort of hugging each other, crying, laughing and just feeling an explosion of joy in the bottom of our belly. Because Martin and Speak, when he said, "I have a dream," we knew he meant we have a dream. Mm-hmm. And we knew that we had arrived.
What has been the secret of these 50 years? If we could bottle it, we could sell it.
That's true. Tell them, Ruby, because I don't know.
I tell you the truth. I when people first used to ask us that, especially young people in our travels, we kind of would give a flip answer, you know, is it, well, we have managed to kill each other. Well, just do one day at a time. Well, just don't go to bed mad. We prefer about things like that. Mm-hmm. We did for a long time, but it occurred to us that they were asking serious questions. This relationship business is not easy.
Right.
You know, how to be together, man, woman, wife, sexual partner, temptation, jealousy, envy, resentment, you know, all these things creep into our lives to one degree or another, you know, and if you're lucky, in marriage, we finally concluded, is a process. It's not something that you do. The wedding is something you do in a day, but marriage is something you do for the rest of your life every day, you know, around some issue, and I just feel it's kind of a percentage game. If there are more things around which you can agree and can enjoy life, then those things are for which you want a divorce, then that marriage feels like it's successful. The same thing with love. I thought I was in love when I first got married, but it wasn't many years into the thing when I realized that I was feeling some things that didn't belong with love, you know.
Mm-hmm.
We were going through some things that I questioned a lot of times, and many times when we have an argument, Ossie, we wake up the next morning, and Ossie would say, "Well, do you wish you'd married so and so?" You know, some question like that, and I get angry at the question. Or he would say, "Well, if you're going to quit me, I'm going to go with you." So what, one thing that saved us in the rough times was a sense of humor. I tell you the truth, because we always. Eventually, we found something to laugh about. You know, the ridiculousness of what the things that were upsetting us, especially after they'd passed, and I used to get angry with him because I didn't think he was a good fighter. I didn't think he knew how to argue very well. And I think there's something about being able to argue constructively and creatively, because sometimes it clears the air and gets some understanding. Because then sometimes we'd have a fight, and the next morning, Ossie would tell me that he understood something. And eventually, he began to feel with me about how I was feeling as a woman. And being a very smart guy, he would read up on the subject, he thought about things, and he began to reevaluate women, me, his mother, women in general, this whole woman as object question, the woman as intellect, mind, me as a person capable of being of use in his work, and useful to him as a sounding board. I'm a good collaborator, but I had to kind of fight my way into his consciousness. I had to move beyond just being a woman. This marriage business is not easy, but we're hoping that this book will give young marrieds some idea, you know, because, for instance, we study everything in school but relationships.
Right.
The most important thing, there's no compulsory course on marriage or child rearing or anything like that that affects us. You have to learn by trial and error. And if you're lucky, you hang together through the rough times and not think that every challenge is an end.
Yeah, and marriage is really what you make it. You have to make what it is you want. Now, in the Hollywood entertainment industry syndrome, a professional or an actor is looked on as a celebrity, as a commodity, and is taught to teach the public to worship himself or herself as an object of divine whatever. Mm-hmm. And if you begin to consider only yourself, if yourself is your only object, then all other things will begin to fall away from you. You have to learn in this business that yourself cannot be your only object. You have to say, myself and my wife and my children, those are the things that mean the most to me, and I don't care what fame does or celebrity does. That's where I will be going, and that's where I stake my claim. You have to be tough and say, I'm going to make this marriage work because if I lose this one, the only thing I can do is get another, which will be just like it. So I might as well make this one work.
I understand. You all were with Malcolm X a day or 2 days before his untimely assassination. Give us a little insight into the man.
Well, I think the last time we saw him, was not too long before he left us. He did come to our house by himself, and just Reuben, me, and Malcolm sat, and we just listened and let him talk. Mm-hmm. And what was very apparent was that this dedicated, very brilliant, very strong character, very spiritual man, had one thing that hurt him more than anything else, and that was his estrangement from his father figure, Elijah Muhammad. Mm-hmm. He never really got over that. And so all of the things that we admired him for, we knew about and the public knew about. But when he sat to talk, and he talked and talked, we could see a young man, a boy, reaching out for a father who was no longer there. And that's the central core of my memories of Malcolm.
Ms. D?
I don't know. I thought of what racism does to us. We're all affected by it, and I think particularly black men, and particularly and women too in other areas like women. But this that his struggle against being relegated to niggerdom,
mm-hmm.
as Ossie talks about in the book, this thing that unfortunately happens in our culture it seems to be like a constant problem. This how do we reach through racism and love each other? And then Malcolm was that attempt for the manhood that Ossie wrote about, that reach toward that for all of us. You saw it all. He carried it with him all the time, and yet he had a beautiful vulnerability and a nice sense of humor with that crooked little smile, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And but I think he was thrust in a direction that was that was more than just himself. He was a person sitting. I met him through my brother Edward, but he transformed my brother, and their families were very close. And then, but he was a man he was a personification of black men in struggle,
mm-hmm.
and so he couldn't have. His personal life was second. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
You know, these people who walk the earth,
right.
who are they come here for more than themselves. They come here to live for a lot of people, just to be part of their aspiration and the thrust. Yes.
Is there a greater appreciation? I'm quite sure you love both venues, stage and film.
Well, I personally prefer the stage because I am a writer, and I find that writing for the stage means that you write a work that will exist on its own terms as long as printing exists.
Okay.
Unfortunately, the work that you do on film will not necessarily exist. Nobody goes and reads a film script,
mm-hmm.
and unless somebody takes care to preserve the film, it could very well disappear. So for me, since I am a writer, stage is my first love.
Well, I can't say that I have a definite preference. I like them both for different reasons. I think there's nothing like a stage for hitting the walls of yourself, you know, finding out what you're all about, trotting the tracks, opening the pathways, and you do it over and over every night on stage. So there's a chance for growth and self examination and use of yourself over and over and over that makes it easier to get to from one point to another. This practice is like going through the path in an uncleared forest. the more you tread it, the smoother and more definite it gets. That's what I think the theater does. It explores the bigness of you and the wideness and the deepness of you, of yourself, that helps you to become a better actor on film, where you're looking, where the camera seems to photograph thoughts and emotions and ideas, and, you know, the subtleties where the camera can get there greater, I think, than on stage. But I think you grow more on stage than you do in film, although there are film actors who master that technique and are just as efficient there as, but I mean, to span them both, I think a stage work is a necessary part of the training process, you know.
Have you all adopted Spike Lee?
Uh-huh. Not officially, but we're working on it.
He's adopted us, I think. I think with Spike kind of brought me into the attention of a new generation or something, you know, and also through our son, I think Spike taught a lot of people in the business. He had something about integrity, and I thought he did the film. The Delta Sigma Theta did it first, but he made a film by the bootstrap, you know. He just did it, and that's what the Deltas did with that film we made, Count Al Cusini. And he gave credit to all the people who helped him. And he took $5 and $500 and $1,000. And my son happened to be one of the investors. So I love Spike for that. He brought people into the union where it was the union. You know, was not known for being. It's kind of, it has a lot to do in terms of racism. And Spike did worked on that front, too. Everybody worked for Spike. You know, men, women, black, white, Asians, the physically challenged, all those. I mean, Spike, he's a conscientious young man, growing philosophically. And so, I mean, he's the most exciting person in that realm that I've known. You
all have worked in virtually all the media, radio, television, film, stage. Any new projects on the horizon?
Well, Ruby has a couple of films in the can.
Yeah.
Passing Game?
The Passing Glory, yes, and where Quincy Jones was one of the producers, and David Salzman and Magic Johnson. And just it's a basketball film with Andre Brower.
And the next one is The Baby Geniuses.
No, that one is before then, really. The Baby Geniuses, that's coming out with Dom DeLuise. That was fun for me because I love doing those kind of quirky
parts. Could I get one in there,
yes,
lady?
Uh-huh.
All right, and I did one with Della Reese called The Secret Path, which has yet to show up. Meanwhile, we have other projects that we're busy working on.
The late Ossie Davis and the legendary Ruby Dee. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions as to future In Black America programs, email us at jhanson, H-A-N-S-O-N, @KUT.org. Also, let us know what radio station you heard us over. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station or of the University of Texas at Austin. You can hear previous programs online at KUT.org. Until we have the opportunity again for technical producer David Alvarez, I'm John L. Hansen, Jr. Thank you for joining us today. Please join us again next week.
CD copies of this program are available and may be purchased by writing In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, One University Station, Austin, Texas, 78712. That's In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, One University Station, Austin, Texas, 78712. This has been a production of KUT Radio.